All right, so last week we finished up in chapter 4. We finished up with the story of Jesus encountering the Samaritan woman at the well, and then we talked about how she became a witness and gave testimony to her entire village, many of whom believed. One thing I just want to revisit before we move on from that, I think it's a great picture of Jesus we get here in chapter 4 after this encounter at the well in Samaria. So if you look in verse 31, it says, this is chapter 4, verse 31, "Meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, saying, 'Rabbi, eat.' But he said to them, 'I have food to eat that you do not know about.' And so the disciples said to one another, 'Has anyone brought him something to eat?' And Jesus said to them, 'My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work.'" So here I think we've got this great picture of Jesus. He's encountered this woman who's believed in him. And not only that, she spread witness of him and belief throughout her whole town. We see that in verse 39. It said, "Many Samaritans from the town believed in him because of the woman's testimony." But here we get this picture of Jesus who hasn't eaten in quite some time. And so, of course, his disciples are concerned on his behalf. But he tells them that he's so fired up doing the work of his Father that he's too busy doing that to even bother with eating. And so this idea that the work itself is his food is, I just think, that's a great picture of Jesus and his obedience and his enthusiasm for the Lord. And then I also want to point out that this story, this theme of food and drink is very much going to continue on into this next couple of chapters, in particular chapter 6, when we get to the feeding of the 5,000, and Jesus drawing this distinction between physical food that nourishes maybe just temporarily for a while, and the fact that he comes as a gift, giving true food and true drink that leads to eternal life. And then we didn't get to go over it, but let's read real quick at the end of chapter 4, starting in verse 46, and we get the second of the signs that John covers in his gospel account. And it says, "So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him, and he asked him to come down and heal his son, for his son was at the point of death. And Jesus said to him, 'Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe.' And the official said to him, 'Sir, come down before my child dies.' Jesus said to him, 'Go, your son will live.' The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. And as he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. And so he asked them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, 'Yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him.' And the father knew that this was the hour when Jesus had said to him, 'Your son will live.' And he himself believed, and all his household. Now this was the second sign that Jesus did when he'd come from Judea to Galilee." All right, so here our author John is letting us know, again, he's been counting the signs that Jesus is performing up to this point, and now we're on number 2. So we've had turning water into wine at the wedding in Cana was the first. And now this with the official's son, where Jesus heals him with but a word and from a great distance. And so this is, John tells us, the second sign. And I just want to point out again, John makes sure to emphasize that the result of this is belief. Remember, John tells us he writes the book so that we might read about these signs and come to believe several things about Jesus, that we might believe that he is the Son of God, that he's the Christ, and that believing in him, we might have eternal life. And so the whole purpose of this book is that these signs lead to belief. And that's, again, what John is emphasizing. Before we move on into chapter 5, just real quick, do we have any comments, thoughts, or questions? Okay. So then we will we'll forge on into chapter 5 and 6. So here's an outline of kind of what we have in chapters 5 and 6. We will not get through the whole of chapter 6, but I hope to get at least into chapter 6. We're going to have three more signs in this section of John's gospel. The first is this healing of of the man who's paralyzed or whose limbs do not work by the pool of Bethesda. The second of the signs will be there down at number 5, where Jesus feeds the 5,000, and the third in this account would be Jesus walking on water. Intermingled here, we're going to have a section where we have a lot of text, a lot of words from Jesus himself that I think that are very much unique to John's gospel account. So I think that's something special that John gives us here. We get a lot of insight and teaching direct from Jesus here in chapter 5. And then, of course, at the end of chapter 6 with the I am the bread of life speech or discourse. So some themes that are going to continue throughout these chapters. And again, remember, all these themes are kind of set up in the prologue in the first 18 verses of John. But this idea of creation is going to continue, that Jesus is the Word. He's the eternal Word who was there at the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. This idea of transformation is going to continue, that he can transform just as he did water into wine. He can transform this man who hasn't walked for 38 years into someone who immediately gets up and walks. This idea of witness and testimony is still going to be very important in this section. Remember, John's gospel account goes through several witnesses. And in this section, Jesus is going to provide 3 of them himself. And again, this idea of belief is going to sort of pervade all of these chapters. And then there's going to be some parallels back to Moses and the Exodus, just as John kind of set up in his prologue. But let's get into these. Backing up, I had a slide. This was from chapter 4. Again, just emphasizing the fact that that the sign was meant to lead to belief. And so Jesus is pointing out that they're asking for signs and wonders. But of course, what he wants them to come to believe in is him himself, not in the signs themselves. We just talked about the official. I think it's notable that sort of the desperation and the proper response he gives to Jesus. It says he believes him at his word. As soon as Jesus said his son was healed, it said he believed. He set off for home without insisting for anything else. And then his faith happened not from seeing, but from hearing Jesus and from believing in Jesus himself rather than seeing the sign. And I think that sort of sets up what happens now with the next few signs, because up till now, at the wedding in Cana and healing the official son, it simply said that the result of these signs was belief. But now, starting with this third sign, there's going to start to be opposition in addition to the belief. And so the belief is going to start to come with a cost. And the belief is going to start to be opposed, because Jesus himself is going to start being opposed. So here we pick up in chapter 5. Let's read the beginning of this, the first 9 verses. So it says, after this there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. All right, so Jesus has now gone to Jerusalem. It says, now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has 5 roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, do you want to be healed? And the sick man answered him and said, sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I am going, another one steps down before me. And Jesus said to him, get up, take up your bed, and walk. And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. All right. So some versions have a verse 4 here that kind of explains a little bit about this pool where this takes place, this pool at Bethesda. And it talks about whether it was a superstition or based on something real, that the waters would be stirred, and it was said to be stirred by an angel, and then that the first one sort of into the waters would be healed. And the commentaries have a lot of discussion about whether this is this is a Jewish pool or a Roman pool. And I don't know that I really have an opinion on that, but what I do think is important for us to know about this man is that he is Jewish. And in fact, that's going to be an important point of contention here in a minute, the fact that he's Jewish and what he's doing on the Sabbath day. But he is Jewish. He has been crippled or paralyzed for 38 years, quite a while. He's also been at this pool for some time. It says Jesus perceives this and is aware of this. So whatever healing properties or powers this pool had, if it had any, it certainly wasn't working very well for this man, right? Because he'd been here seemingly day after day, and it hadn't been working for him. And in his mind, the reason it hadn't been working for him is others always beat him into the water. You know, whenever the healing is about to take place, someone else is able to get there before him. And sort of the reason he says he has no one to put him in the pool. So not only that, I think we can kind of use our intuition here to infer that this man is probably also somewhat of an outcast, right? He doesn't have friends. He doesn't have friends that are there to take him down into the pool. In fact, he even kind of describes himself, you know, he says, when I'm going down, like he's crawling there. He says he has no one to bring him there, but he apparently has some means to try to get there. But he has no friends, no friends seemingly to help him get into the pool and get healed. But Jesus perceives this about the man, perceives that he's been there for a long time. And he asks him an interesting question, I think. He says, do you want to be healed? And then I think there's going to be a contrast between this man, who very much, I think, answers in the affirmative that, yes, he does want to be healed, and sort of the Jewish leaders that Jesus is going to be confronted with later in the chapter. And Jesus is going to talk about their desires and their refusal to want life and want healing. But he asked the man, do you want to be healed? So the man sort of gives him the excuse. He says, here's why it hasn't worked out for me. You know, the man explains, well, there's no one here to carry me into the water. But Jesus says to him, again, using just simply the power of his word, the power of his command only, he says, get up, take up your bed, and walk. The word for get up here is the same word, it's rise. It's the same, basically the same word as resurrection. And I think Jesus is going to make reference to doing even more than raising this man. So, but what he's saying is rise, get up. Arise, because this man is very much horizontal, right? That's the picture we have of him. He can't stand up. He has to lay on a bed. And Jesus tells him simply, get up. But he doesn't leave it there. He also tells him to take up your bed and walk. And then here in the very next verse, we get to the beginning of the controversy here. It says, and again, I like how John always lets us know what time it is, but here he lets us know, or I'm sorry, at the end of verse 9, now that day was the Sabbath. So when I read this, I like to try to imagine this, read this again through fresh eyes as though I'd never read it before. And then he sort of saves the controversy of this story till the very end. You know, the healing happens, you think this is remarkable, and then John tells you, but this was on the Sabbath. Right? So there's more to the story, right? This is about to get complicated, is sort of the impression that Jesus leaves. And then Jesus, we see in verse 13, he sort of sneaks away without this man really understanding who it was that did this for him or being able to identify him. It said, now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, and there was a crowd in the place. And then it says, afterward, Jesus finds him in the temple, and he says, see, you are well, sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. That comment also receives a bit of attention in commentaries. I think Jesus is just simply saying to him, you know, he's given this man a taste of the true life that only Jesus and God can give. And this man who now has life in his limbs and now can walk, I think what he's telling him is there are worse things than being crippled the way he was before, and that he should avoid sin. Because sin leads to worse things. I don't think Jesus is making any statement on whether his sin had led to his condition. He's just simply saying, there are worse things than where you came from. And there are better things than restoring your legs to working order. We have a comment over here with Cole.
I 100% agree with that. And then I was just going to add something else that I think is interesting here that's different than the wedding at Cana is he specifically kind of says what to do. Like the wedding at Cana, he just filled water and then they brought it to the master of the wedding and he tries it and it's wine. He doesn't say turn it to wine or give them any inkling. And this one, I feel like it's almost, sometimes I feel like Jesus now when he does miracles that we're going to read is he's like very, like when he mixes, spits in the mud and mixes it and puts it on some guy's eyes, you know, did he really need to spit in the mud and put it on the guy's eyes? I don't think so. Because he could have just, like, the water to wine where it would just turn to it whenever he wanted it to. He could have done that. But I think it's almost for us to realize that, oh, he's doing something miraculous, if that makes sense. So it's just a little bit.
Yeah, I think very much part of what Jesus is doing is centered around the dialogue with this man, right? He starts off by asking him, do you want to be healed, right? So he very much does want to engage in this. And even though John doesn't tell us the man believed, I think it's clear the man believed him because he got up. You know, whether he believed him because he suddenly felt the life in his legs or what it was, whatever it was, he did believe. And he got up and he actually did as Jesus commanded, right? He took up his bed. You might think, because here we get to the issue, or the controversy about this being on the Sabbath. Put yourself in this man's shoes. You've been lame for 38 years. You're healed. Maybe the last thing you want to do is pick up that bed you've had to lay on, right? You don't want anything to do with that anymore. But Jesus tells him, no, pick it up and take it. I mean, this man is Jewish. Surely he knows it's the Sabbath. Surely he understands the Sabbath rules. I think when we're going to get to the Sabbath controversy, it's interesting. The blame comes down on Jesus. Jesus simply issues a command, right? He hasn't actually done anything, I think, that even the Jewish officials would say is in violation. But this man, carrying a bed, very much would fall under what their rules were for the Sabbath, that he should not be doing this. But this man says, I'm going to believe the one who gave life to my legs, right? So I think that's very much a proper response by this man. So now we get to this dispute here over the Sabbath. So we find out right at the end of verse 9, this happens on the Sabbath. We find out this is bad because, this is a controversy. It's bad in the Jewish leaders' minds because the man had been asked to carry his bed. This is not something he should be doing on the Sabbath. And so we find out that they're very concerned about this. And so we read in verse 10 through 12, says, so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, it is the Sabbath. It's not lawful for you to take up your bed. But he answered them and said, the man who healed me, that man said to me, take up your bed and walk. And so they asked him, who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? This is where we find out that he can't immediately identify him, although Jesus comes back to him later and gives him sort of warning to sin no more, because there's perhaps, again, worse things than being crippled or being paralyzed. But ultimately, Jesus is identified to these Jewish leaders. And we see that in verse 15. It says the man ultimately goes and identifies Jesus to them. And then it says, and this is why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. Some other translations say this is why they began hounding him. But the picture we're supposed to get here is the beginning of sort of a very violent opposition to Jesus, and it's coming out of Jerusalem. And so it begins really in John's gospel here. It says, this is why they began persecuting him. But Jesus has an answer for them, and I think his answer is interesting. So in verse 17, Jesus says, my Father is working until now, and so I'm working. Right, that's his explanation for what's going on, why he's doing these things, and why he's doing them on the Sabbath, seemingly very deliberately, right? I mean, put yourself in the Jewish leader's shoes. Could this man have been healed on any other day and told to pick up his bed and walk? He was there seemingly every day for a long period of time, right? So in their minds, well, this could have been done any other day. And so they see something intentional. But Jesus gives them an intentional answer. He says, my Father's working, and I'm also working, right? And I think that's the picture we're supposed to get with these signs. Again, this is the third sign we read about in John's gospel. These signs are all things only God can do. They're all, in effect, God's creative work, as we see in Genesis 1 and 2. God the creator, who makes something out of nothing, who gives life to the world, who breathes life into man. Jesus is doing works that only God can do. And God is doing these works of new creation through Jesus. And there are people who believe it and can see it, and there's people who are blinded to it and refuse to see it. But Jesus is telling them, my Father's working, and so I'm working. And so he, now not only does he give his justification, but he also draws attention to a relationship between him and God. So he talks about God being his Father. And so if God is not resting on the Sabbath, then neither is Jesus. That's sort of his point here, I think. And then what we see now after this in verse 18, it says, but the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. All right, so this has really escalated the opposition to Jesus, right? So not only is he, in their minds, causing violations of the Sabbath, but now he's equated himself with God the Father. And so it says, in fact, this opposition is not just persecution and hounding, but in fact, they want to kill him. Cole?
Hard to keep making Jax walk up here every few minutes. But I was just going to add, too, for me, I feel like the other side of this is, I mean, obviously this is centered on Jesus, but you also look at the people who are approaching Jesus, the Jews, and it's interesting how he talks about working, like you just mentioned. Like, Jesus is just here to work, and it's almost like they're not working. He's like basically saying, you're not working, and because they're too busy worried about what people aren't doing, what they shouldn't be doing, rather than just doing. And I think we do that a lot sometimes. We worry about what people shouldn't be doing instead of just doing things ourselves. And I think that's a big thing is just, you know, God hasn't asked us. I mean, we do need to help our brothers and sisters in our local church, you know, if they're doing something they shouldn't be doing. But in reality, when we look out at the world, are we so focused on what people shouldn't be doing instead of just doing things? And I think that's what blinded them here to seeing Jesus. And we got to be careful that that doesn't blind us to seeing who Jesus is and allowing that to transform us to be more like him.
Yeah, absolutely. I might phrase it a little bit differently. So they are very focused on what people should and shouldn't be doing. What they're not focused on is Jesus himself, God's son, right? Like that this is sort of his point, is you are blinded to the fact that God is doing this thing. And in fact, he's about to call witnesses about what he's doing. And he's about to say, the witnesses are the very works that I'm doing. They're the Old Testament scriptures, which you go back to, but you're blind to the fact that these things are being fulfilled in your sight. And then they're also blind to the fact that God himself gave witness of Jesus at his baptism. I mean, think about the other gospel accounts about Jesus' baptism. It said, God, there was a voice from heaven that said, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him, right? This is the witness that all these people are missing. They're missing the forest for the trees, perhaps, by focusing on the laws and being blind to the work that God is doing in their midst right now. Like that's what Jesus is trying to get across to them. This is happening in your midst right now, and you're missing it. And so Jesus is going to give kind of a lengthy defense to this group, and I think it's really interesting. So he's already started talking about God's working, and so the Son is working. But now he's going to draw out this relationship a little more. If you look at verses 19 through 21, it says, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing, and greater works than these will he show him, so that you may marvel. Jesus is, he's not only describing himself as God's son, but it almost sounds like a bit of an apprentice role, right? Like he's learning the works of his father. He's learned them from his father, and he copies them. He does them. He does the same works that his father did. And again, I think that's part of what we're supposed to see in these signs, that Jesus is doing things that only God the Father can do. So he's also going to talk here in verse 22 and 23, or actually before we even get to that, in verse 21, he's talking about the kinds of work that the Father does and that he is also doing. He says in verse 21, as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom he will. So again, I think this word raise, he's playing off on the very commandment he just gave this crippled man. He said, raise yourself, rise up, get up. And he's saying, I'm going to do even more than making this man who was laying down without legs stand up and walk. I'm going to make the dead stand up and walk. So he's making a very bold claim to them. But this is something that the Pharisees in particular expected God to do someday in the last day, right? The Pharisees believed in a resurrection. They believed that there would come a day that God would raise his people from the dead, call them out from the graves. And Jesus is telling them, these are the works I'm doing, and they're all leading to this. And in fact, this is the work the Father has in store for me. So he says, the Son gives life to whom he will. In verse 22, he talks about judgment now. He says, the Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son. So now he's making a claim that in fact he has substantial authority, and he has authority even leading to judgment. And so now it very much matters. It very much matters whether you're in the camp that believes or disbelieves, because the one whom they believe or disbelieve in is the one who's been given the authority to judge. And so I think we get this sense then, well, who is it on trial? The Jews may think that they are judging and critiquing Jesus, but Jesus is actually saying, do this at your own peril, because in fact, it's all of you who are on trial, and you're going to be judged on whether you hear and believe or whether you reject. We get a sense of that in verse 24. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. He who does not come into judgment, but is passed from death to life. So again, we talked about last week, there's rewards to belief, but there's also punishments for disbelief. Jesus, again, is pointing towards this great work that will be done through him. He says in verse 25, truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming and is now here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. So the kind of work Jesus is doing is the kind of work that the Father does. It's life-giving work, the kind of life-giving work that can even give life to the dead. He talks about his own authority, having the authority to execute this judgment in verse 27, refers to himself as the Son of Man. Makes a lot of references to himself as the Son of Man. I think an important context we need to get when he says these things is to look back to their Old Testament scriptures and figure out what they would have heard when Jesus says Son of Man. They would have naturally associated this with several things in the Old Testament, but in particular, Daniel. In Daniel 7, one of the visions, we have a vision of one like the Son of Man. And this is where he comes to God the Father. But he comes to God the Father and he's given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. So the Son of Man is one who very much, in Daniel's prophecy, has authority. In fact, he has authority over the whole world, and in fact, the whole kingdom, and in fact, the whole world. And so again, this idea of rewards for belief and punishments for disbelief, we get here in his speech to them in verse 29. And he said, those who have done good, he's basically saying everyone will ultimately be resurrected, which again, I think is something the Pharisees believed, but some to eternal life, and some who've done evil to resurrection of judgment. But Jesus is staking his territory. He's saying that I am the one who the Father has designated as judge. Kind of moving through here quickly. Now I think Jesus acknowledges, it's one thing for me to just say this, but he's not just saying it without evidence. And so Jesus is going to give his evidence here in the remainder of the chapter. He says here in verse 30, he says, I can do nothing of my own. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. All right, but he acknowledges, he says, if I alone bear witness about myself, that's not sufficient. And so he gives three witnesses. And so the witnesses he's going to name are his own works or his signs. And so, again, I think the idea here in verse 36 is that you should witness the signs that I'm doing, and you should understand that these are things that God does. These are things that God the Father does. And so these things testify that he is, in fact, with God, that he is, in fact, of God or from God. I think we got that. Even got that sense from Nicodemus when we read the Nicodemus story, right? Nicodemus came to him and said, we know that you're from God because no one can do these things who is not from God. So Nicodemus understood that the signs testify about Jesus' authority. He says the Father himself testified about Jesus. Again, as I just mentioned, at Jesus' baptism, that's very much a point where God the Father himself testified as to who Jesus was. He said, this is my beloved Son. And then Jesus points out also that the scriptures themselves are evidence of who he is, that the scriptures themselves bear witness. He says, you search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it is they that bear witness about me. And then in verse 40 he says, yet you refuse to come to me that you may have life. All right, so now here's where I think there's a contradiction. There's a distinction, right? These Jewish leaders, they've read the scriptures. They've seen the signs. They've heard of his baptism. And yet they refuse to come to him. Whereas the man who was crippled and was lame, he asked him, do you want to be healed? He very much did. These men refuse to come to him. They do not want to be healed. They do not want the life that he's coming to offer. And so I think that's very much a distinction we're meant to see between these two groups. Let's see. So again, yes, it says they're not willing to come. I think this should, again, call us back to what we read in the prologue. He comes to his own did not receive him. This is very much playing out in this chapter in John. Jesus talks about both the Old Testament and his signs are pointing to something greater. They've witnessed it but refuse to believe. Any comments, thoughts, or questions? Got one with Brother Jackson here.
I just don't think they even believed they needed to come to him. They had no belief that they had sinned, so therefore there is nothing that they need to do in their mind. And I think that's our problem many times. We don't think we have sinned, so therefore we don't need to do anything about it.
Yeah, that's a good point for sure. In fact, I think we're going to continue to get a flavor of the Jewish leaders and the Pharisees that they also very much think it's them, it is they who dictate who is in and who is out of the kingdom. And probably this man who was healed was someone they didn't really consider part of the kingdom, right? He was Jewish, but he was sort of an outcast on the fringe of society, not someone that should be picking up his bed and walking in violation of the Sabbath. He's someone they should be telling what to do. Yes, back there.
I think it's interesting as we look through John to look up at Jesus the man and learn about him and then see what we can apply to that to our own lives. In verses 31 and 32, it could be that Jesus is actually talking about where his own confidence comes from, that his confidence doesn't just come from himself, but it comes from the other who bears witness of him, right, which is probably the Father here. Jesus says that he knows that the witness that he witnesses of me is true. And so Jesus' confidence isn't just coming from himself. He's not claiming that he's God because he feels like he's so awesome. He's claiming that he's God because God has told him that and because he trusts in God. And so then applying that to us, our confidence shouldn't come just from ourselves. We should take that from things that we know that God has said.
That's a great comment. Yeah, thank you. Okay. So, again, as we talked about in our intro class, there's a series of witnesses, and John very deliberately uses the word witness and testify and bear witness throughout his gospel account. And so we have from the beginning, John the Baptist is the first one who bears witness to Jesus. We have Jesus himself in chapter 3, the Samaritan woman. And then Jesus supplies these three witnesses here in the section we just read, that God the Father, his works, and also Scripture. But one thing before we leave chapter 5 behind, I just want to point out, is Jesus now is talking, he's talking again about John the Baptist. He says that, let's see if I can find it. He said, there was another who bears witness about me, and I know that the testimony he bears about me is true. He said, you sent to John. So he's telling them, you all went out and talked to John the Baptist yourself. You investigated, and he has borne the witness to the truth. Not that the testimony that I receive is from man, but I say these things so that you might be saved. But then in verse 35, he says, he was a burning and shining lamp, and you were willing to rejoice for a while in his light. So now in verse 35, he's talking about John the Baptist in past tense. And I think one thing John, the author, doesn't explicitly say in his gospel account that the others do right before we get to the feeding of the 5,000, which is when we turn the page to chapter 6 where we'll be, is John the Baptist dies right before the feeding of the 5,000. He's in fact executed by Herod. And I think this is John, the author's way of acknowledging this. And he's sort of putting, we can sort of infer that when Jesus has this discussion in Jerusalem, this has already happened. John the Baptist is at least someone they've already imprisoned because he's talking about he was the light, and for a little while you were drawn to his light. But now we get to chapter 6, and this is where two more signs will happen. These are things we're familiar with from the other three gospel accounts. Of all the miracles that Jesus discusses in the gospel, or that John discusses in his gospel account, it's these two that are mentioned in the other gospel accounts. The feeding of the 5,000, and then subsequently to that, Jesus walking on water. So these are both mentioned in the other gospel accounts, but there are some differences here. One difference is, we just noted, he doesn't tell us explicitly that John the Baptist is already dead, but we know from the other accounts that John the Baptist has been executed. But John the author tells us, again, because he likes to tell us what time it is, he tells us these things happened at Passover time. And I think that's important for the way John wants us to see these stories. There's going to be references to the prophet and to Moses, again, sort of drawing, when his readers and when the Jews who were experiencing this firsthand, because it was Passover time, their minds were already drawn back to the events of the Passover, right? And when does the Passover occur? That's in our Old Testament, in Exodus, right? That's when God delivered his people from Egypt and slavery and death he takes them across the Red Sea, frees them from slavery, takes them into life. And this event of the Passover commemorated that. It commemorated the final of the 10 plagues and their rescue by God from Egypt. And so I think when we hear people talking about the prophet and Moses, and they're drawing parallels to Jesus and saying, you must be the prophet, you must be the new Moses, Passover is very much on their mind. Jesus is going to connect this feeding of the 5,000 to the idea of manna. Again, taking us back to the Old Testament, to the wilderness times, when God fed his people in the wilderness. Here we're going to see Jesus feeds his people in the wilderness. The other gospel accounts tell us that where this miracle takes place is in a desolate place. So it's very much kind of a wilderness area. Jesus does this in the wilderness. And then the other gospel accounts tell us that John the Baptist has been just killed. So one thing I want to call attention to is, before we talk about these two signs with the remainder of our time, the 5 minutes we have left, the signs are all very much things that people should have associated with things that God himself promised to do. So when he's healed the crippled man, people would have thought about passages in Isaiah, and there's others than just this. But Isaiah talks about a time when God's going to open the eyes of the blind, ears of the deaf will be unstopped, lame men will leap like a deer, right? So God healing this man who's been, or Jesus healing this man who's been lame for 38 years is very much something they would have anticipated God is one day going to do for his people. Feeding the 5,000, I think, would very much draw their minds, or draw the reader's mind, back to passages in Isaiah that talk about a time when God is going to prepare a feast or a banquet for his people. And in fact, it's going to be a feast that people without money can participate in. You know, it says, come everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. He who has no money, come buy and eat. Walking on the water, again, I think, obviously this is something only God can do, but Job talks about God being the one who tramples on the waves of the sea. In Exodus, it talks about, you know, God himself separating the waters. It says, the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. So God creates the paths through the water. Again, these miracles are things that only God can do. All right, so the feeding of the 5,000. Again, John makes sure we know that this happens at Passover time. So this should call our minds back. And in fact, Jesus is going to do this in his I Am the Bread of Life discourse that we'll talk about next week. But it should call our minds back to in the wilderness. So from Exodus 16, verse 15, said, so when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? That's the manna, right? God has given them the manna. They want to know what it is. Said, for they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. And now here, with the feeding of the 5,000, we have Jesus giving them bread to eat. I think it's interesting that we have this whole discussion. He says, where can we buy bread? And it says, but he already knew what he was going to do. Because his point is, he's going to give them bread. They're not going to go buy bread. They can't buy bread. They don't have enough. He's going to give it to them. And again, this is what we read in Isaiah 55, that God is going to do. He's going to say, come, buy bread with no money. So he's going to give them bread, and that's what Jesus is doing here. At the end of this section, it says that people believe that Jesus was the prophet who is to come into the world. I think they would have associated this with Moses. We've talked about this at other points in the class. Moses, in his final days, gave Israel a speech, and he said, there will come a day when God will raise up another prophet in his likeness. They were looking at Jesus after this miracle and making that connection. And then in verse 15, it says, they're ready to make him king. It says, perceiving that when they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, Jesus withdraws again to the mountain. So I know this miracle is one we all know well, and we have just a couple of minutes if anybody has a comment or thought about the feeding of the 5,000. Back here with Jesse.
Yeah, it's also a picture of the Shepherd Psalm. Psalm 23 specifically says, he makes me to lie down in green pastures. And both John's account and Mark's account specifically say that there is much green grass in that place. And then also that it's in the presence of my enemies. And here we are in the context of him displaying who he is in the presence of his enemies, the Jews, telling him, you can't do this on the Sabbath. And yet here he is saying, I'm Lord of the Sabbath. And so his enemies are of no concern as well. So definitely a picture of this, of Psalm 23.
Yeah, that's a great point. In verse 10, I think it's fascinating. Jesus gives a command that says, Jesus said, have the people recline or lay down. And it says here again, there was much grass in the place. But he has them recline as though they're ready for a feast. And you have to imagine all these people are saying, how are we going to feast? There's no food here. But Jesus prepares them for a feast ahead of time, which I think, again, is just that sort of gives you, that tells you this is that messianic feast happening in real time, sort of in their presence. And I think their response to that is, yes, you know, this is the Messiah, only they don't understand. They're ready to make him king.